Welcome to Reports from the Edge, a podcast series where we try to understand our collapsing world. I'm your host, Alex Foley. From the beginning of Israel's genocidal assault on Gaza, foreign correspondents have been barred entry unless embedded with Israeli occupation forces. Since then, what footage we have of events has come from a cohort of Palestinian journalists who have risked life and limb to bring us the news while frequently being targeted for doing so. One such journalist is Abu Bakr Abed, a young football journalist from Deir al-Balah in central Gaza who took the call to report the genocide of his people to the outside world. For those who were watching events inside the Strip closely, his reporting became a mainstay, and his soft voice and persistent smile a small source of warmth among the horror. Abu Bakr announced in March that he had been diagnosed with malnutrition, prompting concerns for his well-being from his colleagues at Dropsite News and his international audience. Concurrently, the threats against him escalated with a smear campaign from Zionists claiming that he is affiliated with Hamas. In April, Abu Bakr made the impossible decision to leave his family and everyone he knew to receive medical treatment in Ireland. In early June, I went to Ireland, where he is still recovering, to visit him and interview him about his experiences covering the genocide. He is extremely thin and clearly exhausted from his ordeal, but says he's managed to put on weight since leaving Gaza. We walked to a local park together and, after stopping to literally smell the roses, decided to take shelter from the wind in a flower garden to have our conversation. Thank you so much for meeting with me. I'm so pleased that we got to see each other in person, and thank you for taking the time. You're 22. I'm struck by how young you are. Frequently when I'm speaking to people in Gaza, I'm always shocked at how young they are, despite the responsibilities they've had to kind of take upon themselves to take care of their families, to provide for people around them. And then I can't help but think about, when I was 20, 22, how little I was doing. Your entire life has been under occupation. That's all you can really remember. Can you tell us a bit about life before October 7th? What was October 6th like? What was the rest of your childhood like?
Well, that's a good question, but October the 6th, October the 5th, October the 4th, and every day before October the 7th was also hellish for Palestinians. And for me particularly, I was trying to finish my bachelor's degree, but then it was interrupted because of the war on Gaza that Israel has waged. At the same time, life before October the 6th, Gaza is just 365 square kilometers. It's a very, very tiny strip where 2 million people are trapped and their lives are controlled by the Israeli forces. So they have limited resources, they have very few and sparse quantities of everything they want. Even if they want to move outside Gaza, they have to take a permit from the Israeli side and from the other sides as well. So our lives were always controlled, and we've been always oppressed and subjugated under this horrific, crippling siege by the Israelis, which has been imposed on Gaza in 2006. So in Gaza, before the genocide, I wish I could have traveled across the globe. I had the chance to travel in 2021 to different countries, particularly the UK and the US. However, I couldn't because of the occupation, because of the financial problems and the poverty, the extreme levels of poverty the population are suffering. Also, it was really hard for me to do a research trip, for example, around Gaza, to continue my sports journalism, because I wish I could be a football journalist, and I was doing football journalism before this genocide, so it was really hard for me to connect with football reporters outside or to go outside. For example, I really wanted to be a reporter inside Qatar, in Qatar. However, I couldn't because of the occupation, because of the borders, and because of everything that's around us. So it was hard to get what you wanted. You just have little amounts of food, little amounts of everything, and you are like probably less than an animal, trapped or stuck in a cage and that you can't really move outside that. And that is the same. Like, I was finding struggles to pay my tuition fees. I was finding difficulties in even, like, you know, having what I really want from food and from other types. My neighbors, they were extremely poor. Imagine what it is right now for them after during the genocide. The unemployment rates are exceptionally high. People didn't have work. People were absolutely striving to get some sort of living in Gaza. People didn't have shelter. Many people I know in Gaza, they were living in dilapidated houses and dilapidated shelters because they didn't have the money to build their lives. So the sense of stability was almost defunct in Gaza before the genocide. And then it was hellish, as I told you, but when the genocide began, the worst of the hells, or the worst of this hellish life has been inflicted upon the entire population. So things drastically changed, and tragically changed as well. And the population right now, they don't have any access to anything, but they are fighting with almost nothing. So for me, on a personal level, when I was living in Gaza was never a spot on this planet. No, for me it wasn't. It was just a death zone and reminder that I left four wars even before this genocide. So this is not the first war that I'm living, and it's not a war, it's a genocide. It is, in fact, the fifth war. This is in addition to the numerous escalations that I had to witness and experience within Gaza. So for me, 22 years, there is no sense of life. It was just a sense of constant panic and a feeling that I would be killed or that I would die. And I was always stripped off. I was always, literally always, stripped off my humanity. So you can just imagine what it meant for Gazans before this genocide. And that's one of the main reasons why a lot of young people in Gaza were trying to flee Gaza even before the genocide. So imagine right now what it is for them.
I remember I spoke to one of my friends online that I've made over the course of the genocide, Ibrahim, and this was months and months and months ago, and maybe a year ago, and I asked him where outside of Gaza would he like to travel if he had the opportunity, and he said Jerusalem, you know, a few kilometers away. He would love to just go there, and he's unable to. So this restriction of movement, the inability to travel outside of that 365 square kilometers is something that I think many people struggle to understand, how caged in you are.
Yeah, you can imagine that you are unable even to go within your own homeland. So it is just Gaza. Even the West Bank is probably practically not occupied by Israel, but it's still somehow theatrically occupied by Israel. However, you can't really go to it. You need a permit from Israel. You need a permit to go. You cannot visit Israel. No way. You cannot, which is occupied Palestine. So then, even within your own homeland, you can't travel. So I look at what it means. So it's not just about traveling outside the Strip, but it's also about traveling within your own homeland that you can't set foot outside Gaza within your homeland. And that's an experience that I had when I left Gaza, because I left Gaza towards Amman, and to travel towards Amman or to Amman in Jordan, I had to go through occupied Palestine. Okay, so the areas on the coastline, the Jericho, the Dead Sea, and the other parts of Ashkelon and Be'er Saba. So those parts were on the coastline. I just saw them on the bus. I just literally saw them on the bus. I was looking through the windows, and I wish I could even set foot there or get off the bus and enjoy the scenes or something, or walk or whatever. But I couldn't do that because all the Israeli settlers, the Israeli occupiers, There was storm in this land and they were enjoying, but me, I wasn't able to do that. So it's a very devastating feeling.
So you mentioned your neighborhood. Can you tell people a little bit about your neighborhood before the destruction of the genocide? I know some people mostly from Beit Hanun through whatever fluke of the internet, and they're very proud of Beit Hanun. But can you tell us a little bit about where you're from, your family,
Basically, my grandparents, so the roots of my family, are from Beit Daras, which is an occupied city near the Gaza Strip. It is also near the coastline of Palestine, which has been occupied and from which my grandparents were expelled. And they had to relocate in Deir el-Balah, which is also on the coastline. And it's a very tiny city, or it's not a city, it's a refugee camp of around 15 square kilometers. And my family spent their entire lives there, but my grandparents, they were not there. My grandfather spent almost 60 years in occupied Palestine in Beit Daras, in his original hometown, until he was expelled forcefully by the Israelis. And my grandmother was also the same. She lived in that area, but for quite a few years. And then they were expelled, and we had to live in Deir el-Balah. So I was born in Deir el-Balah and raised in Deir el-Balah, and I never left Deir el-Balah in my life. So it's a tiny refugee camp of around 15 square kilometers. It was such a very simple refugee camp with loads of palm trees, because Deir el-Balah means, el-Balah means palm, and there means a shrine, which refers to one of the leaders in the Roman Empire when he came into the city centuries ago or hundreds of years ago, and that's why the city was named Deir el-Balah. So Deir el-Balah is a tiny refugee camp with very simple people. We sleep early, we wake up early, because the vast majority of the population there, which is around 80 or 70,000 people, and the vast majority are farmers, so they wake up before the dawn and they go to sleep before the sunset, because they have to work. So it's a very agricultural piece of land with a very tiny percentage of people. And this city was always colored. It was always had beautiful pieces of agricultural land, and it had palm trees, it had green fields of chilies, green chilies, of eggplants, of tomatoes, potatoes. So it was one of the main sources to provide Gaza with vegetables and fruits, because it had also an avalanche of orange trees and citrus trees. But then after the genocide, and it has also wells, so it was also one of the main sources, one of the most predominant sources to provide Gaza with water, and until now, it has the main desalination plants, one of the main desalination plants in Gaza, but unfortunately Israel has cut off electricity to this desalination plant, and it has stopped, or it has been shut down as a result. But then Israel, in August 2024, the eastern parts of the city were totally wiped out and exterminated after Israel invaded the city. So I went to that place, to that area, just a few weeks before I left, and I reported from there, from the eastern, on the eastern outskirts, and the scale of destruction was truly unbelievable, truly unimaginable. And because of the wells and most of the agricultural landscapes are on the eastern outskirts. They're not in the central parts, or they're not in the downtown of the city. They were, as a result, also destroyed by Israeli forces. So that really caused mayhem over those places, and consequently 10 wells were damaged, were destroyed, and that has made for more suffering, or fueled the suffering of the population as they continue to struggle for water and for the main basic necessities. And there were many families, many tribes of people living on the eastern outskirts, like Abu Masib family, Khattab family, Abu Amra family. There were tribes. They lost everything. And most of them loved living on the eastern outskirts of the city because they loved planting, they loved engaging with some sort of activities, and they loved their lives. They have livestock. They had sheep, cows, animals to take care of. They loved doing that because they were, you know, one of the main elements of building a really simple society within Deir al-Balah. But now they have lost many members. I remember talking to one of them, just a 23-year-old young man who's 1 year older than me. He lost his right leg because of one of the Israeli airstrikes, and he is still now being hospitalized inside Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital. His whole family, his two brothers were killed, his mother was killed, and they lost their home, they lost their agricultural land. So the losses the population had to endure in Deir al-Balah only, this is apart from the other parts of Gaza, were incalculable. And even in central Deir al-Balah and in the western parts, because I live in the center of the city, where airstrikes that aimed to exterminate entire families. And that was just, one of the strikes was in the early days of the war, of the genocidal war on the Strip, which exterminated 20 people within just the adjacent neighborhood, and 20 family members were killed, and entire families were wiped out. And the neighborhood next to us doesn't have any marks right now, doesn't have any landmarks at all. So you can just imagine that even Deir al-Balah, which is now, however, the last standing city in Gaza and the capital of the Gaza Strip, because it is the least devastated, nonetheless, it has sustained unimaginable losses over the course of the genocide. So from a simple city, and from people who loved life, who really loved everything about their lives and really wanted to take themselves away from the fuss, away from the noise. Very peaceful people. They didn't even know what a weapon means, and they didn't even know what war meant, although they lived wars before, but they didn't want any wars. They didn't want to get into fighting. But also those people want to go back to their homeland, and they were very simple. Despite this fact, Israel has deliberately caused mayhem in those areas and has really made for their suffering, unendurable suffering, over the course of the past months.
You mentioned that it's an agricultural neighborhood in Deir al-Balah. I read a report some time ago that 83% of plant life in Gaza has been destroyed. I think at that time it might be more now. I've seen posts recently kind of highlighting how expensive the vegetables that remain are, and the fact that they're the ones that can still be grown in Gaza. Is there any sort of agricultural work still being done, and is there any portion of the agricultural land that...
There is. Farmers are still, because farmers find life in planting things and the land resists too. As the farmers resist, the land resists too, because the land is still able, is still fertile to produce more vegetables, more fruits, and more plants, despite the horror. And this is something I myself did during the genocide, when I cultivated that yellow rose, and when I grew those plants, like the lettuce, the parsley, and the basil, and the jasmine itself. So the flowers, or those the roses flowered as well, they didn't stop, because there was always an aim to make sure that life was not going to be stopped. Life cannot be stopped in Gaza, despite the fact that Israel is obliterating all aspects of life in Gaza. So there is still a process to make sure that everything can still be standing and life can still be run in Gaza. But the circumstances under which those farmers and every category of people is working or working, they are just truly unimaginable. Like, just as I told you, sparse quantities of vegetables. So We're talking about around 2 million people inside Gaza. So spot quantities, so that is just a few kilograms of vegetables. A few kilograms, and not all vegetables can grow, unfortunately, in Gaza right now because of the tons and the thousands of tons of explosives Israel has dropped on the strip. So you're just able to probably grow or plant tomatoes, eggplants, green chilies, and zucchini, carrots. So just a few types of those vegetables. But for them, they are trying, they're still trying, but the lack of all these vegetables is making things very difficult. So who would that be? This is not sufficient to the entire population, to too many. So who would get the food? Who would get the vegetables? And if you need, as you just mentioned, if you need to buy a kilo right now of potatoes, I just talked to my family, you need to pay around 30 or 25 euros per kilo of potatoes. A kilo of tomatoes, you need to pay around 15 euros. That is in this country's currency, in the world's currency. So imagine what it means for Gaza's currency, which is shaky, which is every shaker, one shaker, equals a quarter of a euro. So it's 80 shakers, 100 shakers. People don't work. People cannot get their money out because there's a huge inadequacy of cash or of banknotes. So how can people afford that? That's the question. The farmers, they cannot. They have also, as you said, the agricultural land, the 83% of agricultural land, the space of agriculture land, has been destroyed. So how can those farmers grow more fields of vegetables, and more crops of everything, of fruits and other things? We cannot do that. So they have sparse quantities, and those sparse quantities, because of the lack or the shortage of vegetables and fruits, things are becoming extremely exorbitant and sold at extremely hilarious and unimaginable prices, as I just mentioned. But they are still trying to resist the unbearable reality and the stark reality of what it means to live in Gaza.
I'm often worried when I speak to friends there, when I see photos of them with their younger siblings, their children maybe, about the impacts of malnutrition. Specifically, I'm worried about scurvy a lot because of the lack of citrus. You said Dirabala was known for its orange trees, lemon trees, but lots of those will be gone now. You yourself suffered from the effects of malnutrition. Can you talk a little bit about what you experienced towards the end of your time in Gaza?
Before the genocide, it was really hard to find vitamins, to find vitamins, to build up my strength and to recover from my weak immunity, because I had a weak immunity before the genocide. So the doctors advised me to take at least 2 meals of meat and fresh fish every week. Now, with the genocide happening, this was literally unfeasible. So during the genocide, I contracted a variety of diseases, including hepatitis A virus, gastroenteritis, bronchitis, and other types of diseases and viral infections. Because also one of the main factors that is playing this role is the fact that the stagnant pools of garbage and sewage are everywhere in Gaza right now. I remember going to Gaza City. There was the piles of garbage and sewage are everywhere. Literally everywhere. People are living amidst the pools and the piles of garbage, the mountains even of garbage. This is apart from the rubble, so the conditions and the environment is very toxic and very lethal sometimes to them. So during the genocide in Gaza, the malnutrition, you don't have vegetables to obtain some of the vitamins from the natural vitamins. You don't have the fruits to get some sort of agility or health or whatever. You cannot really get that. So you don't have fruits, you don't have vegetables, you don't have fresh meat, you don't have fresh milk, you don't have anything, you just have canned food. And the canned food is of a very, very terrible quality. And the last 3 months since Israel imposed a very probably the most unimaginable and the most unendurable siege on Gaza, not allowing a trickle of aid into Gaza, things have become very difficult. So that's why I was diagnosed with malnutrition, and that malnutrition developed and developed and developed every single day. Is that at some point I wasn't able to stand on my feet. I was just walking from here to this tree, to that tree over there, and I was feeling very tired and very exhausted because of my malnutrition. You need vitamins, you're reporting every single hour, every single minute. So you need energy to replace what you have truly exerted. So you need to think about it that way. That's the thing that I'm talking to you about, but it was impossible to do that. Even I tried to find medications. The medications that I needed were not available in the pharmacies because Israelis also blocked the entry of medical supplies into Gaza and medications. But you don't know why. Like, what is the military objective of preventing aid? What is the military objective of preventing medical supplies? What is the military what is the military objective of starving an entire population? This is just, whoever does this is a Nazi and a fascist army.
You, when we first spoke on the phone, when you were still in Gaza, you said something that's going to probably stay with me until I die, which is, I was thanking you at the end of our call. You were being so generous with your time to me. And I just said, thank you for all of the work you do. And you said, yes, but I would very much like to be a sports journalist again soon. And what made you take up the call to report on the genocide, to risk your life, to begin recording what was happening to your people?
Well, there's nothing more important than my homeland. Like, my dreams are not important. My life is not important as well. My aspirations are now important. In Gaza, we know there is a duty, which is to help defend the homeland. Fighters are different. Not all the fighters are those who pick up weapons. For me, my weapon was my pen, was my pencil, was my story, was my writings, was my speaking. So there was no way that I could even think about just sports or think about football, because it's nonsense what I did. This is my duty. This is my duty towards my homeland, and it's also a religious duty for me. So what else could be more important than defending my homeland? So there was no way. I knew that I had this ability to defend my homeland, and I knew that I could talk particularly to the Western world because I speak English, and that was one of the main reasons. Like, you cannot really sit down. I'm not that one who sits down and watches things, but I am here to have my say, to have my opinion, and to defend my homeland. And that's what I did, and that's why I risked my life. I didn't even risk my life just reporting, but I was denying the Israeli claims that they didn't shell blah blah blah, that they didn't fire at blah blah blah, and I was denying the so-called claimed transparent work of humanitarian organizations, because they were working under the cover of the Israeli military under the supervision of the Israeli military, and they were not fair in distributing aid into Gaza. Therefore, for me, there was no border. That was the priority, and I had to take that priority. And even though that I had to take that priority, I was the only journalist to report on the footballing tragedy in Gaza. No one talked about it. And I can tell you, which is a very unfortunate thing, and I'm very sorry about that, that no one cared about sports. But literally, the only one who reported on football and the sporting tragedy in Gaza and the destruction of sports stadiums was me. So if I were not a journalist at some point, no one would talk about that, no one would know about this. So tomorrow in the future, we are going to hold Israel accountable. We will also hold it accountable for the crimes that it has committed against the sports in Gaza. The destruction of 9 football stadiums out of 10, the destruction of more than 140 football facilities, the killing, the mass murder of footballers and athletes. More than 700 athletes have been killed in Gaza, including 350 footballers, including 100 children. 100 of children have been killed in Gaza, and the killing spree continues unabated. I have to do my work, and I wish I couldn't leave Gaza. I wish I didn't leave Gaza, but I had to, as I just explained.
Sorry, this is a bit of an aside, but I hadn't thought of this question until you just said that. Israel is often spoken about in terms of its right to maim, where they injure people as much as they can get away with. If you think of the March of Return, where they shot people in the knees, the limbs, they tried to force amputations wherever possible. In the genocide, we've seen lots of this as well. The weapons they use try to harm people's bodies, even if they're not killed, to maim them. What impact do you think that's going to have on the future of sport in Gaza? Do you think there will have to be adaptations in terms of, you know, we see all sorts of sports in the Paralympics that have different adaptations to allow people with disabilities to participate. Do you foresee any changes for sport and how it's played?
I hope so. I truly hope so. There are still footballers in Gaza who are sound, and they don't have any injuries until now. They haven't sustained any life-changing injuries, alhamdulillah, but they are still, they have lost their fitness, they have lost their agility, they have lost their clubs and everything about their sports careers. So how can they really resume their careers? And people, and those players in Gaza, I remember doing a piece for the IPF in England in which I talked to four players and they are trying to escape Gaza because they want to continue their sports careers because football in Gaza has been utterly devastated. I also remember talking to one of the officials of the Palestinian Olympic Committee, and he said that we will not see sports in Gaza within a decade, within 10 years. So that's
a decade, wow.
Yeah, a decade. And it was just unbearable. But unfortunately, it's impossible to see sports in Gaza. I'm not pessimistic or hopeless, but I'm just stating facts here that there has been nothing left within Gaza in terms of within sports, so we need years until we rebuild it. But I hope there is going to be support for those organizations in Gaza and for those players, for those clubs, to take them outside Gaza to rebuild their fitness, and then we can go back to Gaza to build the sports, or we at least take them to the West Bank or to elsewhere across occupied Palestine so they can rebuild their fitness, or they can rebuild their agility, and they can restart or football again. Those players were kicking a football every single day. I remember talking to many footballers in Gaza. They haven't kicked a ball since October the 7th. So imagine 20 months without kicking a ball. That is truly insane. That's truly insane. So the tragedy, every aspect of life in Gaza is a tragedy. There's a sports tragedy. There's an education tragedy. There's a health tragedy. A tragedy in everything. So Gaza is a fertile ground for tragedies. Gaza has truly defined what tragedy means. That's what I can tell you.
Of course, any future of sport depends on the genocide ending, which,
first and foremost, yeah.
Which it currently does not appear to be. It seems Netanyahu, the Israeli opposition even, are intent on destroying anything and killing everyone. What was daily life like for you when you were reporting? So many of the people I speak to, their lives are consumed with just finding food, finding water, clean water if they can get it, finding materials to burn for fire. Your life must have been slightly different in that you also, on top of that, had a job and you were responsible for reporting to the rest of the world.
But those tasks were also a part of the daily life.
Yeah.
Because I needed to find materials and to find books to make wood fire and to cook. So I remember I had to, my university books, I had to burn them to one time cook or to one time set up a wood fire. So I remember that I had to burn my own books, my own university books, just to make a wood fire. And that just can give you an insight into what life means. We are multitasking as journalists, and I have to be thankful to my family because they were helping with that. They were exempting me from such extraordinary and untakeable responsibilities just to help me go ahead with my reporting. So my father was helping with that, my mom was helping with that, every one of my brothers and sisters. So I have to be very thankful to them because they helped me continue reporting. But although, even though that they helped me, I also had to go up to the tanks and fill them with water. I had also to find materials to burn to set up a wood fire. I also had to to trek for kilometers to find for kilometers to bring the basic necessities. So the kilometers that I had to walk were extremely exhausting.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
On top of the journalist,
yeah. Being a journalist.
How did you? Obviously, Israel has done everything in its power to destroy communications networks in Gaza. How did you do your reporting? We've seen footage of journalists going up to the top of buildings to try and get a signal. What was it like to get your word out?
Sometimes, as I told you, I had to trek for many kilometers to file a story. For many hours under the sun to file a story, to file a report. So it was extremely hard. And many times we had, because I didn't have any options. The internet was cut off. The communications were absolutely fragile. The line was impossible to get. So I had to wait for days. My story was delayed because of this. So it was really hard to trek and to walk for kilometers just to file a story or something. It was really hard. It was a cumbersome and an arduous journey. And this is apart from the fact you are working within or in makeshift tented workplaces,
yeah.
And you are working within the hospitals that are legitimate targets for the Israeli military, so you might be bombed. I remember in Deir al-Balah in particular, at the Al-Aqsa Hospital, the main place from which I was reporting, one day I left the place, 5 minutes later it was bombed. I was in the same place, so at any point, as I'm talking to you right now, you could have heard my news at any point. So I'm super lucky to have survived and to just move here. I'm very happy about that. So journalists in Gaza are lacking everything. They're working with literally nothing. They're putting their lives on the line for a story or for a report. And they know, they're well aware, that this story or the next story they are doing might be the last.
Speaking of that threat, you were the subject towards the end of your time in Gaza of a smear campaign.
I was always there. It was always, but it was intensified by the end of my time in Gaza, and that's why I had to leave.
Yes, and it followed a similar pattern we've seen with many journalists. I think over 210 journalists have been...
Over 250. Yeah,
250 now. Journalists have been killed reporting throughout the genocide. And usually it follows a pattern. Israel announces that they are somehow affiliated with Hamas. It gets spread along Hasbara channels and on Twitter, social media. The same thing started happening to you, and I started getting very worried seeing that about you. The journalist Hossam Shabbat, Israel announced that he and 5 other journalists were considered part of Hamas, and then within a month he was dead. Other journalists have suffered the same fate. Can you tell us about that experience, what it was like to start seeing that rumor spread about you and what it felt like to have that target on you?
Yeah, it was, there are actually no words to describe what it means or what it meant at that time, because your life, you know, or I understood at that time that every single second might be the last. Like, I was counting the seconds to my death, and I knew that. And my family was terrified most of the time. There was no way to deal with that, because you couldn't stop them. You couldn't stop them from coming. And those smear campaigns grew and grew and grew. And people started talking about that. So the way I was looking at it is that people shouldn't talk about that. So the big figures, the big media figures, tried to say or to, you know, give it importance. You know? And we're not here. This is a very serious subject, a very serious subject, and I didn't want people to make, it was a huge thing, but I also didn't want people to make a mountain out of the molehill. It is a huge thing, but we don't want it, or we don't want to accentuate it.
You don't want it to be
more noticeable, yeah, and accentuate
to feed the fire by fighting
Yeah, exactly. To feed the fire by adding more fuel. Mm. So I told everyone, don't post about it. Leave it like this. If I'm killed, then I'm killed. What should I do? If I'm not, then this is our life. Like, I have belief, I'm a Muslim, I have belief in God, I have belief in Allah, that He has decided my age, He has decided everything in my life. This is my belief. So I told them, this is my belief, and forget about it. Like, I'm not worried about my own safety. I'm not concerned about my safety. But the only thing that I was concerned about, I was extremely worried about, was my family. I didn't want to be harmed to them. So the way it was trying to handle it, so to cope with it, was just making sure that it wouldn't be more noticeable. That's the way. But other than that, I was truly terrified and horrified all the time.
Yeah. You spoke about, you know, that tension with your family and feeling responsible for what happened to them. Can you tell us about the final days before you left and the conversations you were having and what made you finally decide to leave? And if you can, a little bit about the process of leaving. I know some of it's sensitive, so you can't tell us, but whatever you can.
So the last days before I left, as I told you, there was just, I didn't want to leave, and I decided against that. However, I was talking to my family, and they were talking about those threats. So day by day, I had 0% or 1% chance of a 1% chance of leaving, a 99% chance of staying, because I told you I love my homeland and I wanted to fight for it. I wanted to fight with whatever I could. Nonetheless, then my fears grew, my family's fears also increased. So there was no chance. So the last days were just more about talking about this decision and what decision I should take. And that if I stay, what would happen? If I left, what would happen? Will I see my homeland again? Will I ever return? Will I ever see my family, my neighborhood, my home, my room, my street again, my mosque, whatever? So there were very haunting ideas to me, but I had to handle it that way. Like, I had to handle it that way, that I should leave. So the process of leaving the other day, we went from Deir al-Balah, we boarded a bus, and then from this bus we went to Rafah, from Rafah through the Israeli and the Palestinian borders, because Karm al-Zain has two borders, the Palestinian border and the Israeli border. And after that we went to Amman, and we were checked, of course, by the Israelis. And then we went to Amman, and from Amman to Istanbul is a layover, and from Istanbul here to Ireland on April 18th, on the morning of April 18th, and that's the journey.
And you just looked, so we're outside, and you just looked up because you could hear the planes overhead, and I've seen you talk in other interviews about how that brings up the trauma of what you've lived through. Can you expound upon that a little bit and explain, you know, what you feel when you hear that, when you see that?
It's like, this is something like I've been hearing personally for 560 days. So it's relentless trauma that you live with and that cannot be erased within a month, within a year, within years, and it might be not erased at all. So whenever I hear a plane, it really terrorizes me, it traumatizes me, and you can't really think about it if you're that word bomb, although it's a civilian airplane. But this is the trauma speaking for itself, so you can't really imagine. You have an automatic reaction within your body that responds to hearing this sound. So whenever I hear an airplane, it's just an appalling and a horrifying feeling.
I was in Beirut in January, the week that they were renegotiating the ceasefire with Lebanon, and the first day I was there, thankfully only the first day, you could hear the drone overhead, and you could hear the buzz constantly from Israel, and I was very aware that how unsettled everyone became when that noise was present. It's haunting. It really puts people at ill at ease. And someone said to me that they can, it's supposed to be a spy drone, so they can turn the sound off, but they use it as part of their psychological warfare, to make people aware that their drones are in the sky. Can you talk about some of the other ways that they tormented people in Gaza, that they used psychological warfare?
Well, many things. Like, for example, the quadcopters. I remember the quadcopters tried to lure people into specific places to bomb them by playing sounds. And this is a story I reported on back in last August. And also Mahal Hussein, a Middle East reporter in Gaza, she also reported on that, in which, so those incidents, or those horrific war crimes by Israel, they were including people being lured by Israel to bomb them by playing sounds of mothers crying or asking for help or begging for help or children crying, so people could be pushed to go and run towards these places, but they couldn't find anything. So many people were killed in those attacks or in those horrific war crimes by Israel. So this was one of the ways. And the constant sound of the drones, the warplanes, what else? Everything about that, like the Apache helicopters, the gunfire had the echoes of the gunfire that were heard all across. They were absolutely terrifying. The naval forces, the Israeli Navy was very frequently shooting at the seashores. So everything about that was absolutely terrifying. So there was no way, or it was impossible, to find a moment of peace in Gaza during the genocide.
And now, of course, turning aid centers into slaughterhouses, shooting people as they go into metal pens in the south. You've been very critical of the aid organizations in the past, and now, obviously, we have the Gaza, quote-unquote, Humanitarian Foundation, which is clearly a front for armed personnel to make their way into Gaza. What would be better? What do people need at the moment in terms of aid?
It's very simple. Just to open the crossings, allow aid into the strip, very simply. Israel is an occupying power. It must, and it's now occupying, quite on paper, Israel is occupying Gaza right now. So Israel must hold the responsibility to allow aid into Gaza without arming criminal gangs, without luring humanitarian organizations to unsafe routes into Gaza or to any parts of Gaza. Just allow the trucks of aid that are now stationed outside the Egyptian border or at the Egyptian border. Just allow the aid in, let people access aid, the people work on that, and that's it. It's a very simple solution. It doesn't need any kind of complexity at all.
That luring of aid is an interesting point, and something that I learned when we first spoke. You were working on a piece about unexploded ordnances that were killing people and still are killing people because of the thousands and thousands and thousands of munitions that have been used by the Israelis. Some of them don't explode until people step on them later. This is also a hazard that gets in the way of aid being delivered, and the UN mine office, I can't remember the exact name of the organization, have to often support aid trucks in reaching people because of the risk of mines, the risk of unexploded ordnances. In your reporting, how did you avoid those unexploded ordnances? Was there anything you could do?
There were no precautions.
Nothing.
Like, I remember going to Jabalia and people were warning me. I would work at, don't get, like, you're a problem for me, but do not step on the piles of rubble. Because in Jabalia in particular, the Israeli military, the Israeli regime has used booby traps. And those booby traps, after they exploded or they detonated, they left it, so, and like the explosives from them stayed in the same place. But I was truly risking my life with this kind of reporting in Jabalia and other places and in Khan Yunis.
What has been your experience adjusting to Ireland, to this life here?
It's a lovely country. It's a nice country. I'm loving it. I'm really loving it. People here are very welcoming, warm, kind. And most importantly, they have a huge understanding of Palestine, because most people here understand what the Palestinian cause is. They understand the struggle of the Palestinians, because Ireland has been through the same experience probably a century ago. But for me, on a personal level, I don't think it's really like possible to adjust and to acclimatize to the conditions, because my family is still in Gaza. I'm worried about them. My friends are there, my neighbors, everyone. So, and I've been recently here, so it's very hard just to take it that simply and enjoy life here. So it takes years.
What has been the reception of the Irish to you coming?
No, it was lovely. I think some people recognized me in the streets, which was lovely. People know me, know my work. There was a rally a couple of Saturdays ago, and I did a speech, and it was very lovely. Today we're doing the same, so I'm trying to spread the word here around Ireland, and people are understanding more, which is incredibly amazing.
So you've been here for what, 60 days? How many days? 45 days. Your family are back in Gaza, but also your friend and colleague Abdulrahman, who you frequently post about, he's still reporting, he's still there, taking on, you know, the mantle, the work of getting the word out. How often do you speak to him? What do you say to him? What are those conversations?
I speak to him very frequently, to be honest. Alhamdulillah, he still has a line. He still has an internet connection. He's still working, reporting. So I'm trying to, you know, to encourage him to continue, because he's facing depression right now, which is a normal outcome of what he's living through. So I'm always encouraging him or urging him to continue reporting, to continue doing his work. And we're giving hope to each other. We're away from each other, but yeah, we've been working together in Gaza. We're still working together here. We're trying to spread the word, as you said, and to inform people more. And because he's in Deir al-Balah, and I've left Deir al-Balah, I'm telling him to report in Deir al-Balah, people have to know about the city more. So everything about us. And I hope to meet him very soon, honestly. And my other friend was a doctor in Gaza, Dr. Khaled Mhabil. But I hope he will continue working hard and doing his work. That's what I really want from him, and he's continuing. I'm very proud of him. I'm very proud of the work he's doing. I'm very impressed by his courage, by his bravery, by his hope. And I need him to continue, and hopefully we'll meet soon and the genocide ends and his family will be safe. That's what is important. I need everyone to be safe. I need to go back to my homeland, but not only Gaza, but also my homeland. And that's the aim that we're working towards.
What do you foresee in the next coming weeks, months? How do you think this
I have a feeling, I have a hope that the genocide will end very soon, hopefully. I have this hope. I'm very adamant to still believe in this. And I hope the genocide ends and Gaza will be rebuilt. And I hope that I will have a chance to go back to Gaza. I think for the future, we want to rebuild Gaza first and foremost. We want to heal our wounds. We want to pay condolences to ourselves, to grieve our losses, to mourn our deaths, because all of that was, we didn't have the chance to do that, because the genocide was relentless and we couldn't do anything about that. And I left, my friend was killed December 2023. I wasn't able to go and see his grave. So everything about that I want to.
Okay, thank you so much for taking the time. I'm so glad that you're here.
Thank you so much.
And just massive appreciation for all the work you've done.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Reports from the Edge. I hope you enjoyed our conversation. Please subscribe, follow, wherever you get your podcasts to hear upcoming episodes.